Okay, so we want to pick up in the section on Mormonism, and you could turn to page 96. We'll kind of start on pages 96 and 97. We've looked at the four main characteristics of a cult. They do not believe that salvation is by grace alone. They always pervert the doctrine of Jesus Christ and who He is, never really seeing Him as fully God. They have authoritative writings outside of the Bible, and they don't believe in the perpetuity of the church. And that is definitely the case with the Mormon church, because they teach that all, you know, Christian denominations, all churches had apostatized, and that they were reestablishing the one and true church. And we began looking at Mormonism's founder, which is Joseph Smith. And I don't think we got real far along in this section. And the reason it's important to examine the life of Joseph Smith, you know, the founder of the Mormon Church, is because he made some tremendous claims. And you have to wonder whether or not his claims are true and dependent upon the man's character. Depending upon the man's behavior, you may or may not see reasons why you should believe him or discredit, you know, the things that he said. And I know Tom read a portion of Isaac Hale's comments, which was Joseph Smith's father-in-law, here on page 96, but it's kind of where I want to start, and we kind of need to see that to springboard to what else is said in this particular section. But again, understand that the reason I think Brother Cloud is examining the nature, the character of Joseph Smith is to demonstrate that what he did say cannot be trusted. And so Isaac Hale, Joseph Smith's father-in-law, made this statement about Joseph Smith and his brothers, his father, that he was at the time in the employ of a set of men who were called money diggers. And that's kind of what we looked at the last time, that Joseph Smith was involved in finding treasure, buried treasure. But he really didn't have a lot of success in finding that buried treasure. You'll recall they dug a number of holes, sometimes, what was it, 30 foot deep? And then all of a sudden his little stone that was supposed to tell him where the treasure was would move, and it, you know, I think you got the impression that this liquid silver was, you know, passing down through the earth, and when they about got to it, it would slither off into some other location. But he didn't have much success in finding these buried treasures, even with his supposed magic stone or his peeking stone. And so that's basically what Joseph Smith's father-in-law was saying. He also points out that he ran off with his daughter when he was absent, and he did this without Isaac Hale's consent. And so this demonstrates the type of character, the type of man that Joseph Smith was. But the capitalized portion there at the end of the quote is what is rather important as we move on, because he said, "The manner in which he pretended to read and interpret, you know, certain ancient documents was the same as when he had looked for money diggers. With the stone in his hat and his hat over his face, while the book of plates were at the same time hid in the wood." So again, you know, here's a man that's testifying that when Joseph Smith was looking for treasure, you know, he would take his stone, put it in his hat, put his face in the hat, and then supposedly this stone would reveal to him where the treasure was. But it wasn't successful.
And so now all he has done is went from treasure digging to supposed religious prophet. And when he puts that stone in the hat and his face in the hat, that is how he supposedly interpreted or was revealed the Book of Mormon. Anybody else see a problem with that? It just demonstrates the silliness. And there is a lot of silliness associated with the founding of the Church of Mormon. And this is one of the ridiculous things that's found in its history. It says here under number 2 at the bottom of page number 96, Dave Whitmer, one of Smith's witnesses, also testified that Smith translated the Book of Mormon with his peak stone. And I think, yeah, the next point is Emma, his wife. I can't recall if that was his first wife or not, but his wife testified of the same thing. But David Whitmer said, I will now give you a description of the manner in which the Book of Mormon was translated. Joseph would put the seer stone into a hat and put his face in the hat, drawing it closely around his face to exclude the light, and in the darkness the spiritual light would shine. And then the next point, Emma, his wife, testified of this. Look at her quote, or the quotation that's given here. In writing for your father, I frequently wrote day after day, after sitting by the table close by him, he sitting with his face buried in his hat with the stone in it, and dictating hour after hour with nothing between us. And so that's Joseph Smith's wife testifying how Joseph Smith interpreted and wrote the Book of Mormon. It was with this same peaking stone that he used when trying to find buried treasures. There on number 5 it says, Smith's peak stone or seer stone has been seen and acknowledged by many authorities. So don't think this is, you know, just the writings or the findings or the quotations of somebody who is completely opposed, you know, to the Mormon Church. I think as we get to the end of this section, we'll see that this is a stone that is to this day in possession by the Mormon Church. So it is a part of their history. But again, I don't know if you're like me, but you read this stuff and it's absolutely ridiculous. You know, this is how, you know, the God of the universe was going to reveal his word unto mankind through a peaking stone. And one man who not too long ago was searching for buried treasures. But again, notice here, it says Orson Pratt, who was an early Mormon leader, he said, sometimes Joseph used a seer stone when inquiring of the Lord and receiving revelation. That was his testimony. Brigham Young showed the stone to the regents of the University of the State of Deseret, later named University of Utah. One of the regents, Hosea Stout, described it in his journal as a siliceous granite, dark color, almost black, with light-colored stripes, somewhat resembling petrified poplar or cotton wood bark, about the size but not the shape of a hen's egg. In the next section, personal bodyguard of President John Taylor reported that he had seen and handled the stone. In 1888, the fifth Mormon president, Wilford Woodruff, placed the stone on the altar of the Mormon temple in Manti, Utah. And he said, before leaving, I consecrated upon the altar the seer stone that Joseph Smith found by revelation some 30 feet under the earth, carried by him through life. And you can see here, there's others that saw the stone. Mormon Bishop Frederick Kiesler, the sixth Mormon president, Joseph Fielding Smith. And in the letter G, it says in the early 1980s, Mary Brown Firmage, a descendant of Brigham Young,
was allowed to see the seer stone. She reported the stone was not chocolate brown, but rather the color of brown sugar. It was 3 to 4 inches long, 2 inches wide, and had a hump in the middle, which made it perhaps 2 inches thick at the thickest point. And in the last sentence there, the stone was not transparent. Again, a quotation by one of Brigham Young's descendants in the 1980s. So again, the seer stone's quite essential to the history of the Mormon Church. In the next section, it says that the 11 witnesses who claim to see the golden plates, and it's the golden plates that Joseph Smith would interpret or translate with the Peking Stone. And I haven't done a lot of research on this, but I suspect in reading this that that's all the more witnesses there are in regards to having seen these golden plates. You know, outside of Joseph Smith, there's these 11 supposed witnesses that also saw the plates. And so again, are these men the kind of men that we should believe, or did they have ulterior motives in going along with Joseph Smith's stories? Well, notice what it says about these 11 witnesses. 3 were Smith's own family, his father and brother included, which had a poor reputation in the community and which had a motive to support Joseph's religious views. Together with Joseph and his father and brother were involved in treasure searching and divining rods and seer stones. These were the same ones that, you know, were with him when he was searching for buried treasure or hidden treasure in the earth. And they'll talk more about the reputation of this family in later sections. Oliver Cowdery and Martin Harris used divining rods to search for hidden treasure as well. And they were 2 additional witnesses who supposedly saw the golden plates. Cowdery Harris and David and John Whitmer were forced to leave the Mormons in 1838 when they had settled in Missouri. They were charged by Joseph Smith with being evil men. And they in turn charged Smith and the Mormons of great wickedness. And given as an example was a letter that was dated December 16, 1838. And Joseph Smith said of John Whitmer and David Whitmer and Oliver Cowdery and Martin Harris that they are too mean to mention. I'd kind of like to know the specifics of that. You'd think there would be some type of information somewhere that would elaborate upon that. But they were charged, it says, with being counterfeiters, thieves, liars, and blacklegs of the deepest dye. Now, I don't know what a blackleg is. I guess that refers to a leg that no longer has circulation and the limb has died. I don't know. I don't know what that's a reference to. But again, it's just trying to point out, are these men reliable witnesses to having seen these golden plates? Hiram Page had his own peak stone by which he gave revelations. You know, last week when we were reading some of this stuff, you know, Tim, he kind of had the same response that I do to some of it, and it's how gullible must these people have been and continue to be to follow the Mormon Church. But you know what? There was a lot of this in the 1800s. A lot of sensationalism. A lot of cults were established at this time. And you know, and as I read some of these things, though, it honestly sounds very familiar to the charismatic movement. I mean, if you've ever spent much time watching, you know, TBN, I assume it's still on the air. I haven't seen it since the 90s. But, I mean, wild, crazy claims and statements and prophecies constantly made, you know, by these, you know, word faith movement teachers. I mean, you know, like Benny Hinn and people like that.
making ridiculous statements, outlandish prophecies. I know one that Benny Hinn made was that, you know, God would rain fire down from heaven and destroy all the homosexuals. I can't remember the exact details of the prophecy, but in essence, that's what he said. Of course, it never came to pass. But nobody ever stopped listening to him either, even though his prophecies failed to come to pass. But they should have, and these men should never have been trusted. If they were using this peeking stone to search for treasure and had no success with that, why do you in turn believe them when they are using it supposedly to translate golden plate?
Jesus said that those fields are white with harvest. So if we're out there talking to them, they're going to believe anything. So it's really awesome.
But that's not true in everybody's case. You know, think about Marcia and Cody. I mean, they were in a number of churches, you know, kind of at our direction. You know, not just Dawn's church, not just the church in Grafton, but a church in Wood River, right? A church in Roxana. And for some reason, you know, the truth never stuck. You know, but when a lie comes forward, it does. Now, exactly why, I don't know. I mean, it's true, though. The Bible says, some have not a knowledge of God. I speak this to your shame. But the fact that people are attracted to it certainly demonstrates that people are looking for something. But I don't know that it's always the right thing. You know, you think about Marcia and Cody. In Marcia's case, it was really just wanting to have a closer relationship with her husband. It really wasn't searching for something to satisfy that longing of the soul. Tammy?
Well, as we go through, I think of, you know, what pieces that I might be able to use when talking to what is Marcia Cody. And you know, you mentioned earlier that Joseph Seth, the thought of discounting him because he was a treasure seeker, and then turned around and was translating the Book of Mormon. But if you think about the Bible, I think, okay, that's not something I'm going to be able to use, because you have Saul of Tarsus, who was a persecutor of Christians, and you know what I'm saying? God many times in his word uses the baser sort. They turn around and then they are godly and they do serve him. And it just makes me think, you know, we have many things in the Bible that are, of course, they have a revelation of Christ and they preach that, and I don't know that Joseph Smith shows up turning around like that. Just go.
Well, Isaac Hale said that that's what Joseph Smith claimed to him, is that he had given up, you know, that old life of seeking treasures. So that's not something so much that I would use. But what you could use is say, you know, he used the peaking stone that he supposedly used to translate these golden plates as something to search for hidden treasures before.
Yeah.
I mean, doesn't that shouldn't that cause some level of suspicion? That's true. They could make the claim, well, he just had a change of heart. Well, if he had a change of heart, why is he still using the same peaking stone? Did God, you know, translate the peaking stone from something that was supposed to identify hidden treasures to now something that is to use to translate golden plate? In a letter E, it says the witnesses had a reputation of being gullible and some jumping from one religious movement to another. The example given here is of Martin Harris. He was a Quaker, then a Universalist, a Restorationer, a Baptist, a Presbyterian, then a Mormon, and then after that a Shaker and a I don't know how you pronounce this, a Strangite is what it looks like to me. I'm sure they wouldn't pronounce it like that. Stragnite, I don't know. But he went from one thing to the next. And I don't know about you, but I know people like that. I mean, they're just unstable. They go from one thing to another, to another, to another. You know, and again, when they are attracted to your persuasion of Christianity, which happens to be biblical Christianity, you get excited about that. But if they jump from one thing to another, they might jump ship from biblical Christianity as well. You know, one individual that I've been talking with recently, it kind of concerns me because, you know, he for months has talked to Mormons, you know, once a month, I think for years, has talked to Mormons, talks to, you know, basically someone who promotes another theology, certainly something that's considered orthodox, but yet it's much different than what I'm conveying to him. And then I know there's another individual that has his ear and it's talking to him that believes a little differently. And I think that's a recipe for disaster. I mean, here you have somebody that knows nothing about the Bible, who has probably only read, you know, by his own testimony, one or two books in the Bible. So he doesn't know a lot about the Bible, and he has people telling him all kinds of different things. And often what I found with people like that is they just end up being confused. And they never really grow. And maybe it's because they're never able to discern truth from error. And it makes me think that people like this just aren't saved. You know, and I had a conversation with someone about this person, and I think what needs to be focused on is salvation. You know, and I guess in part I speak from experience. But you know, when I truly got the assurance of my salvation and got my life right with God, I just went with the truth and stayed on it for the next 20 plus years. And that's what I have seen in the lives of many others who truly get born again. But somebody who doesn't, they just go from one thing to the next. And that's at least the case with one of the witnesses of the golden plates. So it doesn't appear to be someone who is a reliable source. But you know, to Jamie's point, outside of conversion and preaching the gospel to people, we have to do a good job of educating people, of discipling people, you know, in what the Bible teaches about itself and about Jesus Christ and also about these characteristics of cults. You know, because how many Christians today, with the spiritual environment that we have in the world, would just embrace Mormonism as a part of mainstream Christianity, really not knowing what it teaches? Many would. But kind of moving on there at point number 6, it says the accounts, and this is another section, another point, the accounts in the Book of Mormon have proven to be untrue. It contains what is purported to be the account of an ancient civilization in America that descended from the Hebrews, to which Jesus Christ appeared after his resurrection. And for the couple of weeks that I filled in for Tom in the class, that's kind of what we talked about, is the first and second book of Nephi, because they are what outlines what you see in this next section. Here it says the two main groups in the Book of Mormon are the Nephites and the Lamanites. And the story tells of a family group led by an Israelite prophet named Lehi. He is warned of God to flee Jerusalem at 600 BC. He and his family make their way to the southern part of Arabia, where they build a ship to sail across the Pacific Ocean to America. Two of his sons, Nephi and Laman, struggle for leadership. This leads to the division of the group into two warring factions, the Nephites, usually the good guys, the Lamanites, usually the bad guys, and the last battle between the two groups takes place supposedly in 421 A.D., and it wipes out almost all the Nephites. Moroni, who is the last surviving Nephite, buries the records of his civilization on the hill, in the hill Cumorah, and hundreds of years later, supposedly Joseph Smith is directed to the spot by Moroni. And this is where we get the Book of Mormon. So that's a good summary of actually what takes place in the first part of the Book of Mormon. But again, have these claims been met with scrutiny and examination? And when so, do they stand up to the truth? You see, the Mormon Church will teach that different societies and groups use the Book of Mormon, you know, for archaeological digs and things like that. But notice the testimony of the National Geographic Society in the next section. It says, in a letter dated January 11, 1990, the research correspondent of the National Geographic Society testified the society has never used the Book of Mormon to locate archaeological sites. And we do not believe that any of the places named in the Book of Mormon can be placed geographically by the evidence of archaeology. So as far as we know, there is no archaeological evidence to verify the history of early peoples of the Western Hemisphere as presented in the Book of Mormon. And of course, this is something that was stated relatively recent times in 1990. And I state that because, you know, there were claims, similar statements made about the Bible 100 years before that. You know, they said that there was no indication that the city of Jericho ever existed. There were people who said that the Hittites never existed. There was no evidence for it. Well, now both of those things have been established to be true. And there's probably a dozen other, you know, references to groups of people or cities in the Bible that were said not to exist, but now they've discovered evidence that they do. But here the statement made by the National Geographic Society was in 1990, in modern times. And to my knowledge, there still has never been anyone who has verified these supposed ancient peoples and cities. And I would think the burden of proof would be on the Mormons to present such evidence. Here we also have the testimony of the Smithsonian Institute. In 1996, the Department of Anthropology of the Smithsonian Institute, Washington, D.C., issued a similar letter. They said, the Book of Mormon is a religious document and not a scientific guide. The Smithsonian Institution has never used it in archaeological research, and in any information that you have received to the contrary is incorrect. Smithsonian archaeologists see no direct connection between the archaeology of the New World and the subject matter of the book. So again, another institution claiming that there's nothing in the Book of Mormon that corresponds with the archaeological evidence that's been discovered in the United States. And under letter number C is also something that I have noticed when reading through the Book of Mormon, is that there's references to things in North America that, at least from what we can find, were not here until after Columbus discovered the New World. The Book of Mormon teaches, for instance, that there was wheat, horses, chariots, cows, elephants, silk, linen, and even steel. I know some of them that I saw included wheat, horses, and steel. And I thought to myself, I didn't think those things existed in North America at that time. And this seems to confirm that. So, if that's the case, why are they mentioned in the Book of Mormon? Well, again, because they were mistaken.
we'll stop there for now. Does anybody have any questions or comments?